Moncrief on News Talk.
Now, in a few hours' time, the inauguration will begin of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, and it's historic for all sorts of obvious reasons. The sitting president won't be there. The city is swarming with military. The US has rarely been so tense and so divided. And 400,000 American people are dead from a pandemic. Michael Collins was Irish ambassador during the Bush and Obama years. He's now DG of the Institute of International and European Affairs, and he joins us now on News Talk. Good afternoon, Michael.
Good afternoon to you, Sean.
On a practical point of view, does an inauguration take a long time? And while you're sitting there, does it get kind of chilly?
Well, it does take a long time. It may take less time for the president, but for those of us who are guests there, obviously you have to get there in good time, in very good time. And obviously you have to linger a little bit longer after the president himself leaves. So, and on the particular, well, on the first occasion that I was there, Sean, in 2009, I think the wind chill was about a minus 11. So while we had our eye on the president, we also had our eye on the temperature gauge. It was really, really cold. It was one of the coldest inaugurations, I think, of all times.
My God. And so do you keep warm? Given that it's a first Obama inauguration, a very historic moment, and so you have to appear interested rather than, God, I'm freezing. I wish I could go home now.
Oh, well, nobody wished they could go home. But there was a certain amount of preoccupation. There was even talk at one stage of briefly of moving it indoors, which they have the capacity to do, or they would have had the capacity to do in the circumstances. But, people needed to stay warm. We were actually warned or advised by the State Department, by the Foreign Office, State Department in Washington, to bundle up and to be warm, because we would be sitting around for quite a little bit of time before the president arrived, and obviously throughout the ceremony itself. But look, that was incidental. The key thing was to be there. And for me, as ambassador at the time, and for Mary, my wife, who was also invited, it's one of those occasions where we both got to be invited. It was just a singular, rare honor, one that was just an absolutely unforgettable experience.
And the protocol surrounding these things, as I understand it, heads of state are not invited, but ambassadors are. And where do the ambassadors sit in relation to, if you like, the main action?
Well, we're sitting right beside the main action. We're right up on that dais, which many people will have seen in the unfortunate events, the desperate events, the tragic events of the 6th of January. There's an elevated platform built, and we're sitting right there within 50 feet of the president. So we're absolutely adjacent to him and to the whole event. So we're very, very privileged, in a very, very privileged spot. But it's one of these great occasions when the State Department in Washington leaves no room for ambiguity as to what they expect, because they send out a very clear message about who they did not expect foreign dignitaries at this occasion. So they said if foreign dignitaries were not invited and not expected, which was a great, a beautiful piece of clarity if you're an ambassador there, because naturally for the Obama first inauguration, any event, everybody wants to be there. Everybody in the world wants to be there. But that's not the protocol for these occasions. The protocol for these occasions from the American perspective is that the countries are represented. In this case, Ireland was represented by the ambassador. And what an honor that was.
And in terms of where you sit, I assume they're very careful about who sits next to who, like China isn't sitting next to Taiwan.
Well, there's a kind of a section, I think, Sean, which is kind of allocated to the diplomatic corps. And within that section, I think you were free to sit wherever you wanted. There was no kind of control within that. But having said that, you were still within, very, very short proximity to the action, as it were. And in addition, you actually had this vista out onto the mall, the Washington Mall. And, I know it became a source of controversy with the Trump administration and his inauguration about how many people exactly were on the mall. But for the first Obama inauguration, there were indisputably about 1.8 million people there, right in front of the dais, stretched out all the way, if you know Washington, stretched all the way out from the Capitol, right as far as the Washington Monument, as far as the eye can see. I think it's probably the only time in my life that I'll ever be literally in the company of 1.8 million live souls.
Yeah, it must be an extraordinary sight. And then afterwards, do the invited people get to go to the inauguration ball?
Oh, well, yes. I mean, but even before, that's a long, that's way into the evening time. And there are many inauguration balls, and you can't go to them all. Obviously, you have to pick and choose which one, you have to pick the one you want to go to. But before that, and after the swearing in had been completed, and after the president, the new president has left, we get to be brought back to Blair House, which is the government guest house, which is right across the street from the White House. And there we wait for another little while until the president, in this case, President Obama and Michelle and his entourage, they made their way down Pennsylvania Avenue. They went part of the journey by car, and then they walked the remaining maybe mile or half mile. And that, again, was just a triumphant moment as the Obamas entered the White House on foot, as they did. And to be right beside that, again, was wonderful. Later on in the evening, there are these balls, which the president attends, usually very, very briefly, because he goes from one to the other and tries to take in as many as he can. We were at one particular ball. The president did show up, but it was a really, really big occasion. I'm not sure what they're doing this year. I think they're all virtual. Mm. But again, the night goes on and on. But they were somewhat different times to what we have at the moment. They were considerably different times. And, the sense of kind of the hope, the euphoria, the excitement, and the historic nature of the first inauguration was something, obviously, which is it made it all the more memorable.
And people may remember when Obama was taking the oath in 2009, and I think we have a clip of it now, he stumbled over the words.
I, Barack Hussein Obama,
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear
that I will execute the office of President to the United States faithfully.
That I will execute
the office of President of the United States faithfully. And will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
Yeah, now, as people may well remember, that just to be sure, they made him take it again later, just in case there was any dispute over that. Was there a little shudder through the crowd when he stumbled over those words, Michael?
There was. I think there was a little shudder. And personally, I felt very sorry for the Chief Justice, John Roberts, who's a good friend of ours, good friend of Ireland's indeed. It was... For something that I'm sure was well rehearsed, it just he strayed slightly from the oath. And as you say, it had to be done again the next day. There was a little anecdote at the time. I think that Rahm Emanuel, who was the chief of staff of the White House, he insisted on a second swearing because, according to Obama, Rahm loves swearing. And well, in any event, it had to be done. I mean, there was that little bit of doubt about it. And they just wanted to make sure for sure. Belt and braces. So the Chief Justice did go back to the White House the following day, and it was done again discreetly. But it was a little bit embarrassing. But look, it didn't take away from the vastness of the occasion, and just what was being done that day, and obviously the first African American, the first Black president of the United States. It was a moment. It was a triumphant moment. A lot of water under the bridge since then, of course. Mm-hmm. But for that moment, at that time, it was something to be savored, and it was truly, truly inspirational.
We were talking about the inaugural balls, should be said. These events are, for you, is this work? You're working? Are you kind of schmoozing and making contacts and stuff, or is it fun?
Oh, well, look at Sean, this is work. I mean, I know people don't always see it in those terms, but, this is work. You've got your eyes wide open. You're looking at who's around. You know, it's hard to just maybe account for how golden that time was, Obama coming into the White House and people wanting to get in that door and to be with him and to be the first in there, indeed, or the second in there, or early in there. It became a matter of national preoccupation for many, many countries. Now, for us, we, of course, had St. Patrick's Day bearing down upon us. I say bearing down the best sense, but it did mean that we had to have our ducks in a row. And, you know, on the 20th of January, our ducks were not in a row because, you know, nothing had been formed, nothing had been agreed. And there were huge expectations, of course, that, you know, we would be in that door. And it was my job, the embassy's job, to make sure that we were in that door. Now, in hindsight, of course, Obama revealed himself to be more Irish than we ever really fully appreciated, maybe even at that time. But at the time, you know, I mean, it is a very competitive place. So you might say, oh, well, listen here, you're out there, you know, getting around and up on that dais with the, you know, or at the balls. It's work, and you better have your eyes wide open, because it's very, very competitive, and you must make sure that whatever advantages we have, which are not inconsiderable, that you obviously deploy them. And that you get your time with the president, and that you get to ensure that for Ireland that we're well positioned for a new and incoming administration. Because don't forget, I mean, there was an outgoing administration of 8 years, so everything was changing. Everything was changing. All the people were changing. Everything was changing. So we were scrambling like everybody else, and Obama was a very new character, and so we just need to make sure. To have made absolutely sure that we had that we were in the first instance at least in that White House door in March, and indeed we were, and the rest it took off after that.
Yes,
but at the time it wasn't quite so obvious, and it's never quite so easy.
What's the path then, Michael, from today to, you know, let's make sure. Now, in Joe Biden's case, we'll talk about that in a moment. It's probably not going to be an issue. But who do you have to get to make sure that the Taoiseach's visit goes ahead on St. Patrick's Day? Is it Rahm Emanuel at that time, the Chief of Staff?
Oh, well, I think, I mean, it's an entirely different situation now, because obviously President Biden is entirely 100% indisputably Irish. And indeed, and he's already kind of made absolutely clear that his Irish credentials are to the fore. So, look, I mean, our stock is very, very good. We don't, I shouldn't imagine for one moment that we would have to do too much scrambling. But very, very important in all of these things, never to take these things for granted either. And, you know, obviously you have to get through to the White House, the people in the White House who are involved in arranging these things. But there again, when you look at this new White House, from the president right down through the whole system, including the deputy chief of staff, General Dylan O'Malley, Mike Donnellan, Jake Sullivan, and even you have somebody like the press secretary, Jen Psaki. Now, you might say, you know, Jen Psaki, you know, what she got to do with us? She is one of ours. She is Irish, indisputably Irish. She's at least three quarters. Well, as far as I know, she's three quarters Irish. So we have huge assets in place. So they're even more obvious now than they were in the case of Obama. Although we had wonderful people in the White House at that time, people like John Brennan, Dennis McDonough, people like that, all of whom were great. But it just takes a little bit of time for a new White House to settle. But the difference this time round is that you have very seasoned practitioners. Biden and his team have been around before. They know the way around Washington, and I'm sure the place will be run in very, very professional terms.
Yeah, and obviously, as you say, Biden, even recently and during the campaign, said he was Irish several times, keeps quoting WB Yeats, etc. So, you know, that's good.
Oh, absolutely.
What are the tangible benefits of that?
Well, they are absolutely incalculable, because again, I said it earlier on, I mean, Washington is a very competitive place. You've got 180, 190 countries in the world trying to get in that door, trying to assert their whatever, or defend the issues, or assert their positions on various issues. You to have a president in place who is Irish to the core, and he is Irish to the core. He is deeply, deeply Irish. I think it's of incalculable value. Sometimes we wondered in the past, where was Irish America? Was Irish America a diminishing phenomenon? You only have to look at the president himself and all the people around him to realize that the Irish are still there in force. And obviously, insofar as I'm concerned, a force for the greater good. And I think, we are blessed that in this time of uncertainty, that we have the leader of the free world, or who will be the leader of the free world at 5 o'clock this afternoon, somebody who feels like one of us. Now, look, he is an American. He'll have American interests at heart. You'd expect him not to be otherwise. But insofar as he's not an American, he's an Irishman.
Yeah. Now, but say, in terms of its practical benefit, could that be brought to bear on a UK-US trade deal, for instance?
Well, I think we just need to be a little bit careful, Sean, and not maybe having excessive undeliverable expectations in relation to the president, what he might do for us, or indeed what he might do for Europe, or what he might do for the UK. I think overall, President Biden is a reconciler. He is somebody who obviously will work literally across the aisles, as far as people are willing to stretch out the hand to him. And he'll work across the Atlantic as well with us, obviously, with all the advantages that I've just mentioned, with the European Union, which is obviously a place and an entity which he respects. But also, one would expect also that he will have, there will be some expectation that he will reach out to the UK as well. And it's definitely in our interests, I think, you know, that the UK, you know, has a good relationship with the United States, as I'm sure they will. And that Europe overall, and Ireland in particular, you know, obviously benefits from somebody who is an Atlanticist, who is interested in the issues that we're all interested in, and who will obviously bring down the temperature, you know, both in the United States and in terms of relations with friends and allies.
But specifically, obviously, from an Irish point of view, our concern around the position of Northern Ireland within the terms of a trade deal, within the terms of our relationship or its relationship with the European Union, I presumably Ireland would hope that that might be brought up in the context of a trade deal with the UK.
Well, he already made it demonstrably clear, and members of administration made it demonstrably clear that there would not be a trade deal were the situation on the island of Ireland to be injured, but if the peace process was to be undermined in any way. They made that abundantly clear. And people like Jake Sullivan, who's the new national security advisor to be, I mean, they're all around these issues. So, you know, I think there will be a concern to ensure that our interests are protected. And I've no doubt about it that it would be for the president himself and for those people around him, they are invested. They are invested politically in what has happened in Ireland, the good things that have happened in Ireland through the peace process. They will want to protect that. And I think I wouldn't imagine that any UK government would wish to challenge that in any serious way. To the extent that they did, or it became an issue throughout the negotiations over the last year, I think the American administration made itself very clear. And clearly, the Northern Ireland Protocol, or what has resulted in the meantime, clearly protects our interests. And that's something, obviously, that the Americans themselves can feel best pleased about, because obviously they put down a marker and that marker was attended to.
Now, obviously, I don't need you don't need me to tell you he's got a huge job ahead of him, not least trying to heal the rifts in his own country, if only to a certain extent. Would you have any concerns, Michael, about his health?
Well, I don't know anything about his personal health. I mean, somebody was saying they saw him on the television the other night, getting his vaccine, and you know, he had his sleeve rolled up. And they just comment on how muscular the man was. He's a 78-year-old man. So obviously he keeps himself fit. I have no knowledge other than the fact that he is fit. He will be, I think, the oldest person taking the oath of office to be president. But he does seem to have the energy. He does seem to have the fitness. And he's also somebody, I think, who's capable of pacing himself. He's surrounded by, you know, people of the highest caliber. I mean, one of the things that will be notable, and not that we will necessarily agree or that everybody will agree on everything about what the Biden administration will do, but he is surrounded by good people. So I'm sure he will at least share some of the burden and avail of the good talents of all the people around him. But he looks like a fit man to me, but he is a 78-year-old man. And he, while not wishing to be in any way ageist about it, I mean, obviously, I presume he will find a way of pacing himself appropriately and finding a way of operating within his capacity. But look, to all intents and purposes, he looks fit. He's definitely up for the job. It's the job he's always wanted. If you asked me back in 2009, when I saw him on the dais, you know, as vice president, to be, you know, could I envisage one day that you know, 11 years later, that he would actually be the president? You would have been hard pressed to say that is a surefire thing. But in fairness to the man, he has fought adversity all the way along the line. He has achieved his high pinnacle, and I'm sure he's got the energy and the fitness to do an incredible job, a job that desperately needs to be done in terms of uniting America, reconciling America, you know, healing the fractures and the divide, and easing the tension and uncertainty that has crept in.
Michael, thanks very much for speaking with us today. That's Michael Collins, former Irish ambassador to Washington, D.C., now Director General of the Institute of International and European Affairs.
Moncrief on News Talk.